Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 104. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Finding Dory, the next sequel from Pixar. Helping me talk about it are Joel Mayward from CineMayward and Griffin Kale from our very own Real World Theology. Pixar is not known for making lots of sequels, but when it does, so far, it's kind of been 50-50, so we try to figure out where Finding Dory lands as a follow-up to Finding Nemo. We talk about sequels in general, we talk about Pixar, we talk about a disappointing 2016 summer movie season, and we definitely, as best we can, talk about parenting. So, make sure you guys are checking out Real World Theology, make sure you're checking out our Facebook discussion group, checking out our Facebook page, checking out our website for all kinds of information about what we're doing, all the information, reviews, top five lists, all the stuff that we're putting out. Follow us on Twitter for the latest, and make sure you're following our guests. Make sure you're following me. You can find all that in the episode at the website. Please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends. Leave us a review. Leave us some feedback. We would love to hear what you guys think, especially if it's awesome and five-star reviews. So again, rate, review the show, and we'll keep hopefully making good content for you guys. In the meantime, we've got a really great show for you this time. Here it is, episode 104, Finding Dory and Patient Parenting.
I told Griffin this earlier today, that because of how social media has been going recently, at least at the time of this recording, I have made a commitment to myself, and we will see how well I can keep it, to only say positive things, or at worst, neutral things.
Neutral or above.
On social media for the next week, or I'd say the next week and a half, basically till next Saturday. Because some of the some of the conversations I've been in recently have turned south rather quickly, as social media can lead to. So the problem there is, I think at best I would be neutral about Finding Dory, the movie we've all come here to see.
Wow, interesting.
No, that's not true. That's not entirely true.
Okay.
I wanted to transition.
Yeah,
but
I'm not totally surprised.
But me personally, or that anyone would feel that way?
No, that anyone would feel that way. Yeah, I mean, are we getting into it? I mean, is this the time?
It's all the time. So
I mean, for me, here's the thing. I love a good film that hits at the heart of adults. For that is like an animated film. If I showed this to my nephew without him having ever seen Finding Nemo, which is true for him, he's like six and loves cars, God forgive him. if I showed this to him, he would not understand why. He would not tell me that was a good and fun film.
Hmm.
Okay.
Well, okay. So you were, Griffin, you were just on the Real World Rewind.
Yeah.
Episode with Blaine
about Finding Nemo, which is,
so I mean, can you, I mean, like, I want everyone to listen to that episode if you haven't listened
to
it already.
It's like 30 minutes. Yeah. Please check it out. It's a quick
snippet. give us like the 15 second kind of rundown. Like what were your thoughts on Finding Nemo?
Okay. Finding Nemo is a great story because you don't need any backstory to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It's front to back. You've got lots of fun joking. You got lots of great fun characters, but the through line of it is some really good redemption stories in the life of Marlin, in the life of Dory, in the life of Nemo, and so when you watch that film, I think that you can point at and say, well, it's amazing. It's a really fun film for kids, and then parents and adults can watch it and really understand it, and kids can understand why it's redemptive. They can, and maybe not verbalize that it's redemptive, but they know, oh, like Nemo found his dad. Yeah, and that's great. Mm-hmm. I think that
some so you're pretty high on Nemo.
I'm pretty high on Nemo. I think some of the themes in Finding Dory, and I don't mean this. So I don't mean this in the sense that like the MSRP is that who rate? That's who rates games. Who rates movies? Anyways, like whenever they say like adult content, they uh-huh. mean like sexual things, okay, yeah. or like drugs sure. or whatever. Whenever I say this, this movie has too much adult content in that emotionally, mm-hmm. A lot of the themes are just not. For kids to understand, like that, it's going to be. I just feel like it'd be difficult to understand. I don't have kids.
Well, but you could level the same criticism against Inside Out, could you not?
Yeah, but Inside Out had enough fun characters that you didn't like. Okay, my other problem with Finding Dory is they didn't tell enough of the backstory for you to understand why it's funny that Marlin is control freak. Mm.
Like enough of the backstory of Dory or enough of the backstory of the parents?
They
or?
Didn't tell enough of the Finding Nemo backstory. And if they made okay. that, it's like Incredibles 2. I'm interested to see how Brad Bird does it because it's by the time that movie comes out, it's going to have, what, been 10 years since Incredibles came out?
I thought it was like 20 years.
Well, more than that.
I mean, it's, yeah. it's yeah. And so, okay, I think you have to retell the entire movie or give away the Incredibles for free because... In this case, with Finding Nemo, it's the same thing. 10 years, at least, since Finding Nemo came out.
Are we not going to do, like, can we do some, like, free script writing for Brad Bird right now? Where it's, like, the opening of The Incredibles is really just, like, newsreel footage and newspapers.
Yes, yes.
And internet articles that say, like, Hero Family does this, Hero yes. Family does that. And then we kind of join them
and then you
in,
have
the,
some,
in the middle.
And in there you have some splash scenes of like one of the characters doing something that explains their personality, either mm-hmm. just like a little trait of their personality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think with this one, with Finding Dory, there's just none of that. Like I get that Nemo and Marlin are father and son. I get that Marlin is a control freak father who like is still trying to figure out how to like protect his son. And like care for Dory, but what I don't get is why why I care, and yeah. they don't really explain enough as to like make it funny or interesting. Mm-hmm. I just know that that's true.
Well, it brings up some ideas about sequels in general.
Yeah,
and when we talk about sequels, it's always interesting to see like who picks up the torch and wants to tell another story. And in this case, Andrew Stanton, who wrote and directed the first Finding Nemo film,
yeah.
also worked in, wrote Wall-E as well. He directed and co-wrote Finding Dory.
Yeah.
So obviously he wanted to keep telling the story that he'd started telling. We have basically lots of the original cast back. Not that the cast was actually that big to begin with, kind of impressively small. And somehow this sequel, which people asked if we needed at all, has now become, it just passed Civil War for the highest grossing
oh, yeah.
domestic
so
film.
It's so popular.
Yeah, at least, like I said, again, at least domestically mm-hmm. In 2016 so far. So that in and of itself is pretty impressive for a sequel. I mean, it's not necessarily impressive for a sequel to make more money than its predecessor, because after the predecessor comes out, people like it, they buy the videos, they go, oh, we get real excited about the next one. So that's not impressive. It's impressive that either the movies have been so bad this year that this easily beat out yeah. everything else,
that.
Or well, I'm sure that's actually that's part of
that's
it.
Actually, that
that's
has
a conversation
to,
that,
has that
we can continue to have
yes.
on the Facebook discussion group.
Yeah,
because that's definitely what I'm pushing pretty hard for.
Yeah,
but it's still obviously people are enjoying it enough to want to go see it and yeah. want to see it multiple times.
Yeah, and I don't hate the movie. Yeah, to be fair, I did like it. I just there are just things that I have with it.
Well, so. Yeah, so now we kind of, like I said, I would encourage everyone to go listen to the Real World Rewind, the Tongue Twister podcast episode of Finding Nemo with Griffin and Blaine, because it'd be, especially if you're listening to this one, it'd be great to listen to that one, because as Griffin says, we're going to talk about things that you might want to already have a basis for in Finding Nemo that we're going to hopefully build on, much like the movie is hopefully building on Finding Nemo. But with that... I'm kind of interested in where you land, Joel, with Finding Nemo. Like, does it?
Yeah, with the original film, right?
Yeah. Because you're a father. Like, I imagine all fathers should instantly connect with Finding Nemo, right?
Absolutely. And it's definitely changed my perception of watching that film since becoming a dad. Because when I first saw it, right, like I don't even know, high school, college, something like that.
Yeah.
And then watching it now as a parent. And it was actually the first film that I showed to my oldest son. And it actually semi-traumatized him. The shark sequence. Was really scary for him and freaked him out, and he doesn't watch movies now. So there's a part of me that is a little bitter towards Finding Nemo, but I still think it's like it's part of the Pixar pantheon. It's one of the most beloved of all the Pixar films, maybe up there with Toy Story, the Toy Story films. And so I think that's partly why Finding Dory has been so successful is there are so many parents in our generation that this is the film that their kid keeps going back and asking to watch over and over. I have so many friends with kids who this is the film that they watch like once a week or
really?
Kind of on repeat in the background. Huh. Absolutely. My sister's boys, they love it. And it does somehow connect with them because there's enough silly sequences. Griffin mentioned that. There's silly sequences, mm-hmm. But there's also these heartfelt moments.
That aren't too high for kids not to be able to understand.
So I do like Finding Nemo quite a bit. I wouldn't put it in
the upper echelon.
Yeah, I actually think that Finding Dory seemed more accessible because it was more plot-driven or action-driven, where Finding Nemo feels more character-driven, mm-hmm. where you're watching Marlin and Nemo, and they're both in their respective journeys, but they're really... They're external journeys, you know, they're doing all these different things outside, but there's a lot of internal stuff and lessons that they're learning and ways that hopefully by the end of the film their characters are different. Where Finding Dory literally feels like one jump to the other, mm-hmm. of we're going to this place and we have to escape from this room and now we have to escape in this you know, maze of pipes. And ultimately we're going to find or hopefully find Dory's parents, but it's kind of a singular goal. And yeah, so I think the part that I totally resonate with what Griffin's talking about, of where you need to go back and rewatch Finding Nemo to really fully grasp some of the emotion, why I should care about Dory this much. Mm-hmm. But I think in doing that, if you watch Finding Nemo and then you watch Finding Dory, it feels like, particularly Marlin, like didn't learn any lessons or none of those lessons.
He didn't.
Yeah, that was gonna be what I would mention towards the end of the show. I was gonna ask if anyone else. Oh, let me say this too.
Yeah.
As usual, we're gonna spoil this movie. So if you haven't seen it, which apparently by box office numbers you've seen this movie already.
Yeah. If you cared.
Yeah,
you
possibly were twice or three times. We're gonna do spoilers. We're talking about the whole movie, but that was one of the things that stuck out to me. I hate Marlin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, hates probably a too strong of a word, but I feel like if I'm going to go on a journey with somebody in a modern, you know, what would be considered a family friendly animated film, even if it's Pixar and there's some heavy thematics and even some emotional heft, I should at least partially like one of the protagonists. And I really just don't like Marlin. He was hard for me to take in Finding Nemo. I mean, even though they kind of gave him a reason to be hard,
you knew why he was hard.
Yeah. But at the end of the film, at the end of Finding Nemo, Marlin comes to the point where he said, "Oh my gosh, I was this way. That's totally wrong. I can't be ruled by fear and anxiety. I realize that now."
Mm-hmm.
I'm letting go a little bit. Obviously, we don't, you know, much like anything we do in our lives that has a grip on us, be it Pokemon Go or Facebook or whatever, like, there's always the temptation to go back. There's almost nobody who changes a personality trait cold turkey. As much as I want to only say positive things on Facebook, I probably can't just do that and never say anything negative again.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I said, not cold turkey. I'll probably mess up, which I think is pretty reflective. But Marlin goes, I think, too far as a character. He becomes a character of himself to prove a point or some theme in the story.
Yeah, and that was what... It was so odd to me. And I get, to some degree, okay, the movie is not too... It's not set too far in the future after Finding Nemo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get the sense that, I mean, Nemo hasn't grown up at all.
It doesn't look like, yeah.
Yeah. Dory is still, like, she still remembers, like, one thing. So so nothing really has happened in that time. So I'm guessing it's very possible. And I will say, I loved the thing, and I'll go, we may get back to this later. I love how they set up the timeline for how she meets Marlin.
Mm-hmm.
That was so wonderful and such a really, really, really neat way of telling a story there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I don't get the sense that much time has passed, and I'm okay with then, like, Marlin struggling. Like, he's, like, you know, just out of rehab, and he's, you know, kind of figuring it out for the first time, and, you know, maybe he's relapsed a little bit. That's okay.
But he just completely forgets. He
completely forgets, and they have to retell the exact same story with him of him finally, like, kind of giving up at the end and allowing a little bit of, like, giving up a little bit of control.
Mm-hmm.
But even at the end, he still goes and follows Dory to make sure she's okay. Like, and I get that's, like, his protective father and protective friend thing, and he wants to make sure she doesn't, like, drift away. I'm understanding of that. But, yeah, it just, it bothers me that as a character, he didn't change. He didn't have a new thing that was bothering him. And I would have been okay with that if he had a new thing. And Marlin's just a flawed character. He's the Tony Stark of the Pixar universe. But it didn't seem like that was the case.
Well, that's all you really need, right? You just need Marlin to, at some point during his journey, to go, oh, yeah, I'm doing it again.
I learned this. Yeah, I forgot. Like,
but he has to be reprimanded towards the end of the film.
Well, and I think in the first film, like, he has Dory to balance him out. So he's this neurotic, anxious fish.
Mm-hmm.
But rightfully so, right? His son is lost.
Yeah.
And he's freaking out about it. And then Dory comes along, and she is this balance. You know, what would Dory do? That's what they say in the second film, right? And Nemo reminds him of that. But in the second film, it's really just Marlin and Nemo. And they don't, on a number of levels, they don't really they don't serve a purpose to the narrative as a whole. Like, they don't necessarily contribute a ton in the actual rescuing of Dory or in finding the parents. They're just kind of along for the ride on their own separate.
You kind of need them in the movie to make it a Finding Nemo film.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't. It's just kind of Marlin and Nemo.
Yeah.
And Nemo gets to be that person that's alongside Marlin and can remind him of those things. But Nemo's personality isn't the same as Dory's, with that carefree.
Yeah.
Like, she is so opposite of him. Like, she doesn't care about anything because she can't remember. So she's just kind of nonchalantly, I'm not worrying about anything. I'm going to bounce on these jellyfish. But Nemo is, you know, trying to figure out, how do I tell my dad, stop worrying?
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of loses some of that and becomes more just obnoxious,
mm-hmm.
like you were talking about.
And
I think that doesn't serve the film well. What I like how Hank... Can we talk about Hank for a little bit?
Yeah.
And how he is he's my favorite character in Finding Dory. And I think his interactions with Dory are parallel to the interactions that Marlin had in Finding Nemo.
If Marlin, if Marlin maybe had a little more character depth in Finding Nemo.
Yeah. Like, Hank just seems to be, if they made a third film in this series, I would love to watch Finding Hank and watch him escape from some aquarium in Cleveland. You know, doing all of his escape artist tricks.
Yeah.
But he was just so interesting, his kind of Eeyore personality, but his willingness to help other people by the end. And he's really the one that seems to change the most. Mm-hmm. Like, he has the most significant arc in the story and transformation. So I was like, man, we just need more Septopuses or whatever they're called. Septopi.
Septopi. And he's got such a cool way that he, you know, from the very beginning, he tells you what his motive is for everything. He wants that tag. He wants to go. Like, that's, and he'll do anything. And, like, the entire movie, he keeps going back to that. It's not like he throws that away and immediately starts helping Dory. He's only helping Dory to get the tag. And so he can get on the mm-hmm. train and go, or the truck. Sorry. And obviously by the end, you know, there's that great moment where Dory and him, like, she just like, no, like, we're not going. Like, and you're coming with me. Like, you don't get to stay. Mm. And that's such a cool moment. But it does. It's great because he is a character that is actually dynamic Whereas it feels like at this point, Nemo's job in these movies is to fight with his dad. Marlin's job is to be controlling. And Dory, at some level, you know, she grows and changes throughout this film, and I think develops a great sense of emotion herself that she hasn't had in other films, because she couldn't remember anything. How could you have emotions if you don't have any memories to base those off of? I get that. But yeah, I think Hank is a great foil to the really lacking personality that Marlin and Nemo possess. Mm. And I'm not really sure why that is. I mean, they had an entire movie to develop that, and they didn't. Mm. Which bothers me. It bothers me that they didn't like build off of that. And that's, you know, here nor there. Maybe they did. Maybe they hadn't seen the film in 10 years either.
Yeah. They're like, oh, that's what we're supposed to be doing. Well, okay, so I feel like we're being a tad critical.
Yes.
Which I don't think is necessarily undeserving in this case. But changing gears, I would say, especially Joel, you mentioned how you think it would probably be easier for a kid to follow along, or, you know, a younger viewer to kind of follow along, because it's more adventure-based, it's more action, or action beat. Mm-hmm. than finding Nemo. So what do you take away from finding Dory as a kid? Like, what are you seeing that's happening in this movie that maybe sticks with you if you're, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever age kids go to see these movies at.
I think, the first thing that comes to mind is how both Dory and Nemo, as fish that have special needs, you know, like mm-hmm. the loss of memory and this tiny fin, play significant roles and do significant things, and that there are people or fish, I guess, a community in their life that is willing to love them in the midst of that and accept them for that and say that this is not a weakness, but it's a strength. It's just mm-hmm. this unique personality trait that you have. And I think that's significant, I think, for any kid to see, whether that's a kid that might have some sort of different needs or abilities, or a kid who doesn't and needs to see how they should treat others mm-hmm. And love others in their community in that way. I think that's really significant to see that Dory, she doesn't necessarily overcome her memory loss, right? Like she kind of does in some ways, and there are more flashbacks and she works through those things, but it's also something that she just learns to accept. And that's just part of who she is, and can love that part about herself. And I think that's really significant for kids. And the other thing that comes to mind too is the her parents and the way that they show and communicate love to her. There's some of the more loving parents I've seen in an animated film, if you think about it. Like, they're not very...
They're alive.
I would say they're the only parents you've seen in an animated film.
This isn't an orphan story. They're not divorced. They're not, like, they genuinely love each other, and then they show that love through this committed sacrificial action and patience, and that's just a remarkable picture of parenting right there. Like, and the moment that really, I mean, got me as a parent, and, you know, the waterworks start coming, and sitting there. I actually watched this film not with my kids, because, like I said, they don't like movies and they wouldn't go see it with me, but I watched it with a group of teenagers, because I'm a youth pastor and I brought a group of teens, and they thought it was entertaining and fun. But that moment where there's the reuniting of Dory with her parents and you see all these shells that are leading back to this one point, I thought that was beautiful and just as profound as anything.
I cried too, Joel.
It's this amazing moment of love, but it's so unique because it's not necessarily it's not based on this like immediate sweeping emotional kind of moment. It's really based on a long-term patience, you know, this discipline of, we are staying here, we are going to put shells out everywhere, and we are just going to hope that she comes back. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's not something that's based on how they were feeling in that moment. It's a love that's based on commitment. And I think any kid watching that and being like, man, that's what love is supposed to look like. I think that's a really cool picture of it. Seeing parents that are around and love each other and love their daughter.
Mm-hmm. So I want to press you a little bit with that, Joel, and say, so take that to a non-anecdotal level, like, or well, actually take it to an anecdotal level. Don't take it to like such a broad level. What does that look like in real life? Because you're saying that I'll quote your really great review where you said Finding Dory serves as a powerful picture of parental love and the significance of familial reunions. So how does that parallel good parenting? Like, what does that practically look like? I mean, you're a youth pastor, so you're probably having parents come up to you and saying, oh, woe is me, kid is doing whatever, what should I do?
Like, yeah, totally.
What does that look like in real life?
I think of so many parents, and myself included, who just find themselves frustrated with their kid or, frustrated with somebody when they're disobedient or not listening or didn't take your advice or those kind of moments. And even thinking of how Marlin gets frustrated with Nemo sometimes in both films. With Nemo's wanting to go off and do something more adventurous. And Marlin's like, no, you shouldn't do this. He's kind of this helicopter parent. And the parents in Finding Dory, and I don't even know if they're ever given names necessarily. Do they have names?
Jenny and Charlie.
Yeah, I remember because they're like, oh, you're Jenny and Charlie's kid. Dory, yes. Is that you?
Yeah.
Oh, Jenny and Charlie's kid.
So they... oh, that's interesting. I totally forgot that.
That's the thing she remembers is their names at some level, at some point. Yes. Anyways.
So with this idea of loving a kid through thick and thin, and even in their absence, you kind of have this prodigal son kind of parallel, even though Dory didn't run away necessarily because she wanted to, but this is just what happened. And being able to be committed and sticking with people. I totally think parents and kids can see that in their parents and be like, man, why is my parent putting up with me this way? Or can learn to appreciate that maybe later on in life. But just seeing that sense of commitment and just painting a picture of a family that genuinely loves each other through thick and thin, I think is something pretty remarkable for our culture to see. Not that that kind of familial love can't occur in families that, like with step parents or foster parents or adoptive parents or families that have gone through divorce or mixed or blended families. I think that can happen, absolutely. But this is it's the kind of quality of love that I'm talking about, not necessarily that, her parents are just together. It's that they are the kind of parents who are just going to be committed, even when it's really hard. It's not convenient for them in any way, but it paints this picture of love goes beyond circumstances and convenience. And I think that that's something, particularly when we were talking earlier about, I can defriend you on Facebook and how quickly our relationships can we can pick and choose those things. They're somewhat flippant in our culture of immediacy. The idea of patience and commitment being affirmed in just about anything is it's fairly unique and countercultural.
Yeah.
So I did appreciate that about that, their portrayal of love and the way that they show it in the film.
Well, it's very interesting to me too, because I'm not at that stage with my new son that he is what I would imagine the teenage years to be. Where he wants to run off, do his own thing, because he knows everything about everything. But, lots of the advice that I see people who are in those stages getting is, be a safe place, be a place where they can come back to, have a family life that is stable, loving. Mm-hmm. So, at some point, a kid's probably going to be disobedient. A kid's probably going to do his own thing, but know that they can always come home. And you're just laying the shells out all the time, like going like, this leads back home. This is familiar. This is where love is. and we're just waiting with open arms for you to come home.
I think of a podcast I listened to recently called Invisibilia. It's from NPR. I don't know if you guys it's an amazing podcast, and there's a recent one about one of the host's family members and her sister who deals with a lot of emotional issues and trauma, and they talk about solutions and trying to find these solutions. And
is this
she
about
interviews
the village?
Yes,
Denmark or something like that?
Yeah, the village in Europe where they take in people with mental disabilities, or you know, people that are, instead of institutionalizing, then they take them into their homes as their guests. As the, I think they call them their boarders. Like they are their, this is their room and board is now provided by this family. And as they explore that, by the end of the episode, the host has interviewed her dad, who's talking about his daughter, who has these emotional outbursts and tears at her eyebrows or pulls her eyelashes out or things like that, and his regret that he tried to fix it. He tried to solve this problem, you know, and tried to make her, you know, be more emotionally normal.
Yeah.
And finding Dory, there's these parents who, instead of, you know, trying to quote-unquote fix her, they want to equip her, you know, on how to remember some things. But they also are just like, this is who you are, and that's amazing. And they're so patient and present with her. And I thought about that at my own parenting and with my own kids, who I have a daughter who can be fairly emotional and can feel very strong things and be very passionate about what she believes. And how do I be present with her, and how do I be patient with her? How do I equip her to handle those emotions and express them in healthy ways? But how do I also not just try to fix that because it's convenient for me, or try to make her into somebody that she's not, because I just want her to fit in or make my parenting look better? I can imagine what they didn't have this scene, but I can imagine what other fish in that tank would have been telling Dory's parents as they leave, you know, as they follow her through this pipe and out into nowhere. I can imagine the advice being like, no, you just need to stay around and keep it safe here, and she's gone, and you just gotta, you'll have another baby someday, or something like that. Do you know what I mean? And they don't show that scene, but they don't necessarily have to, because they're the parents that, of course, they went down that same pipe, and of course they went out into the open ocean to go find her.
And that's such a, it's such a cool thing that they do, that they don't have to tell you that that's how it worked. That, you know, they don't have to, they don't have to describe any other story where you just know, oh, they just waited and they were just patient for their daughter. They didn't get out of the pipe and then immediately like, okay, well, let's just try to have another kid so that we can fix this problem. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. Sorry, that's not what I'm just saying, like, that wasn't the story, and you did need to be told another story, another variation on that. But yeah, I think what you're saying about their parent, I mean, yeah, I remember, and we came down pretty hard on this one as well. I remember whenever The Good Dinosaur came out, I had a conversation with a buddy of mine who's a dad, and he's got two little kids, a boy and a girl, and he and I often talk about film, and I just told him I didn't really like it, and he was like, yeah, why not? Like, I listened to the podcast. Why did you not like it so much? And I just was like, yeah.
I thought you said you listened to the podcast.
But he's just like, I was just like, yeah, I just didn't like the dad. I just felt like he was not a good father. And he was like, oh, I thought he was a great father. And I was like, well, why? And he's like, because he apologized because he was wrong. Like, he knew he was wrong, and he just said he was sorry. And that seems like such a small thing, right? It seems like such a small thing in some ways to be patient for a child that is young and naive. And it's going to make mistakes. It seems like such a small, like, obvious thing, but there are tons of parents that just don't do that. And that's not meant to be like a, I don't know what it's like to be a parent. So I don't know how much patience that takes, but I just imagine if I was just impatient like that with some of my friends, you made a mistake. You made a lot of mistakes. If occasionally they made a mistake, you know, what if I just, every time that happened, I just gave up and walked away? And there was a time where, in my naivety, I would have done that. I would have made that decision and just given up and walked away. But yeah, they're a great picture, these parents, of of two people who, like, yeah, like you're saying, really love each other. That's clear. It's not like they're a fighting couple who are, like, staying together for the kid. Like, no, they're together. Yeah. They're together because they love each other and because Dory means so much to them. Mm. And I just, yeah, I just love the way that they put it to like, she's like, you know, I think the expectation was like, why didn't you go search for her? Why didn't you come search for me, mom and dad? They were mm-hmm. like, oh, we knew you would just come back to us in your Dory way. We knew that you have, like, you were special. We believe that you are special.
You would definitely, Dory would get a participation trophy.
Yeah, yeah.
From Jerry and Charlie.
From Jerry and Charlie. We knew that you are a great kid, and that you, like, we knew that this was the way that we were going to connect to you because you did know how to follow the Shells back home.
I was going
to
say that, and that was like one of the few things they connected with their daughter before they lost her.
Yeah, it was one of the few things that we knew about you. We knew that you could do before we lost you was that you knew how to follow the Shells back home, and it's such a beautiful thing to have these through lines, and I think that's that it. Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, Joel, and I don't have kids or I'm not around kids enough to understand really what they might understand. But yeah, I think that sort of story was one of the parts that I was just like, do 6-year-olds really get that? Like that parent was being patient with them? Because mm-hmm. it took me 25 years to realize like how grateful I am for my parents and mm-hmm. how patient they were. I don't know if that's true for all kids. It's probably not, but I just was wondering what you thought. Because are you a parent, Joel?
Yeah.
Okay, great, yeah.
So 7, 4, and 1. And I don't know that they would comprehend the depth of that, you know, like how complex and the actual sacrifice. I know that they don't comprehend that now, like just how much, you know, time and money and energy mom and dad pour into just keeping them alive, you know, just giving them food and shelter and getting them around safely. That's kind of those things that you just take for granted as a kid. But I think what Finding Dory kind of shows is how it does show that in a safe way and in a narrative sort of way, just how much parents do matter and the kind of love that is. Because I can imagine with little cute giant-eyed Dory when she leaves, you know, when she's lost, how terrifying that is. And if you've ever been a kid that's ever been lost in a store, you know, you can't find your mom and dad, or if you've ever been on the parental side of things where you can't find your kid, both of those moments are very emotional and pretty terrifying. And so I think the film does a good job of navigating those emotions and communicating them in a story, animated story sort of way, which is accessible. But I don't know. I think you're right. I think parents probably would appreciate that scene with the parents and the reunion far better than kids would. But I think kids would intuitively understand that something important just happened. If they've been watching the film, like, they know that this reunion, it means something and it matters. And maybe it's just their own concrete thinking that they can't understand why or how significant that really is. But maybe that scene is more for the parents. These films do feel like they're made for both kids and parents, both Finding Nemo and Finding Dory.
Oh yeah. Well, I would say most Pixar films in general feel that way.
Yeah. They try to push that line.
I feel like there's always like these dual layers of theme going on, mm-hmm. like what you're going to get out of it if you're older. Not necessarily a parent, but, you know.
Yeah, I think a great
as
example.
An adult,
Toy Story 3 is a perfect example of this. Yeah. Like, yeah, the adults who saw it whenever you know, they were younger, mm-hmm. that Toy Story 1, you know, they see 3 and they're like, yeah, I do remember what it was like to be a kid mm-hmm. and kind of love those things again. And the kids, you know, they get the, you know, oh, they found their home again. Like, that's wonderful to them.
Yeah.
It's very easy to point at those things. Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, kids aren't probably wrestling with a sense of purpose.
Let's hope not.
In the Toy Story films. But they are wrestling with interpersonal relationships, welcoming the outsider, things like that. This is kind of asking you guys to speculate a little bit, but we've talked about the parenting piece or kind of what kids are picking up on. And there was a little bit of talk about this. So I don't necessarily want to talk about it for a long time, unless I guess we want to. But there have been some some riffs or some waves made about the idea of adoption and adopted kids going to see this film. So much so that one article writes that viewers who have been adopted or who have experienced foster care may resonate with many of Dory's feelings. Longing for birth parents, unwarranted guilt about the circumstances that led to their separation from those birth parents, a sense of loss of control, a sense of confusion and chaos, and dreaming of a happy reunion. And I am not adopted. My wife and I have adopted our son. And so I was really interested in kind of thinking about this, but I didn't pick up on it at all. But then again, I'm not dealing with that. Do you think that's something that parents need to be kind of be weary of going into this film? Do you think the themes are out there enough, or do they swim around that topic enough for kids to pick up?
So I don't know if you knew this about me, but I actually am adopted and have recently, over the past couple of years, done exactly that. Like, I sought out my birth mom and met her for the first time a year ago. And so I can totally resonate with that feeling of who is this person? What are my origins? Where did I come from? Mm-hmm. What is this reunion going to feel like? And I can see those things. I would wonder if the article that you're referencing, it sounds like they're more cautioning parents of adopted kids that this might bring up some feelings of wanting to go and find those parents as maybe a bad thing. And I don't know that that necessarily is the case, as long as it's something that people are willing to talk about and mm-hmm. There's open and honest conversation and dialogue and willing to wrestle with those feelings. It's a complicated process, just like Dory's journey is, yeah. Right? Like what that requires and entails and the emotions that come with it. And it could be complicated for both parties, the people on the parents' end and the kids' end. But I don't know. I didn't necessarily pick up on that subtext while watching the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't either. And it's interesting that we're talking about it. I think that, from what I understand, and this is coming from, knowing three families who are in the process or have recently adopted children, that it's really difficult nowadays to find an agency that will encourage or even allow you to do a closed adoption, mm-hmm. that everyone involved doesn't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that because they recognized, like the agencies over the years have recognized, like this is just not long term. This is not really
not good.
It doesn't always end up well for the, mm-hmm. and some kids don't ever have to worry about it. I don't know if that was the case for you, Joel, like where, it took you, like as a kid, you never really thought about it or what. I could imagine if I got to be the age of 15, mm-hmm. 18, 20, and then was being told, oh, you're adopted this whole time. That would be pretty difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's interesting to me that's definitely not a practice anymore or a common practice, yeah. is to have these closed adoptions. But I didn't see that as a major through line. And here's why. Dory wasn't co-opted into another family where she had a dad and a mom.
Well, she had a dad and a brother, kind of.
No, she was crazy Aunt Dory to Nemo and Marlin.
But that's still a family, right?
Yeah, but I don't get the sense, like I get the sense that it's more of the story of a child who leaves home, has this other found community wherever they're at, and then and then decides to return home. I didn't feel like it was like a child leaves home and is adopted into a giant family, like in this really true sense, and then they return home. Is that?
Yeah, Nemo or Marlin and Dory really are peers. I don't really view them as Marlin being a parental figure to mm-hmm. Dory in that sense.
He probably does, but she doesn't.
It's more like it's this wacky friendship, right? And that's really what the first film plays up. And there's even those moments where Dory, actually in both films, where Dory is really leading Marlin and setting the tone and setting the pace. So I don't see that kind of a adoption subtext there, but I do see, I could see how it could be a part of a conversation in an adopted family afterwards, and mm-hmm. the uniqueness of families, and again, talking about that familial love and commitment and what that entails, and even just supporting people in their journeys if they want to do that. Like, I know that Marlin and Nemo have to wrestle with that. Like, Nemo asked that question at one point, does this mean Dory's not coming home with us? You know, does this mean if she's found her parents that she's not going to be around us anymore? And at least being willing to ask those questions in adopted families, not necessarily to the point of somebody leaves and never comes back.
Yeah.
But can we support, how do we support this particular individual's journey, whatever that entails, in a way that's going to be genuinely supportive and helpful and beneficial, and that we're walking alongside them through that. But yeah, I don't see that as necessarily a significant theme that is raised by this film.
Yeah. So, I mean, we say that sitting here interpreting a film from our own, you know, lenses, from where we've come from the things that strike us, from the things that don't strike us. And so, Joel, I like what you said when you said that's definitely a conversation that can be had. And I think, you know, if you know your kids, especially if they are adopted, or if you're adopted, you can kind of have that introspection and talk with whatever your family looks like at the time. But I also like what Griffin pointed out, which is something that I haven't seen in any of the pseudo like red flag adoption Finding Dory articles, which is, you know, historically there has been a long history of closed adoptions where someone adopts a child and there is no contact with the birth parents. But recently the trend has become open adoptions. You know where you came from to some degree. And it cuts out the only thing that I saw in the film that might have raised a red flag for me. And that was more or less up until Dory meets her parents, she seems to be, because she has a couple lines that I would have normally let fly under the radar if it wasn't for having read some of these things before I went and saw it, which is like putting the blame on herself for her separation from her parents.
Okay.
Which I think is something that is very, very prevalent in adopted kids.
Yeah.
You know, why did my mom not want me? Why did my dad not want me? Obviously, I've done something wrong, which is absurd because you were typically
infants.
Nothing. You did nothing, you know. But there's still, like, why don't people want me? This is, like, the thing that makes me cry every time I watch Short Term 12. You know, like, what is it that has happened that has made someone decide not to be my parent? And Dory seems to have these kind of side comments like, oh no, like I let them down. I got lost. It's my fault. It's my fault. It's my fault. But outside of that I don't really see a lot of the adoption angle, even though that's kind of a big piece. Though, fortunately, I think big picture in real life, hopefully the open adoption system, even though it has its own challenges, it is not by any real means easier than closed adoption, hopefully fixes some of that guilt, or alleviates, because I don't think it can ever really get rid of it, because I mean,
yeah, it probably creates a whole new set of problems, but I think it does let up on the idea of finding out many years from later, or feeling like, well, you know, and maybe having that explained at an earlier age by the people who gave you up.
Well, either way, I am a big fan in general of talking about adoption anytime I can.
Yeah.
Because going through adopting a child has made the adoption metaphor of our adoption in Christ more real to me than ever. And I don't necessarily want to like turn this into the Sunday school lesson portion of it, but there is a thing about being part of an adoption, whether you're in a family that has adopted, whether you are adopted, whether you know friends who are adopting and you're good friends with them and you're supporting them along their way, that when the adoption, when the adoption metaphor becomes real to you, it's one of the most powerful metaphors in all of Scripture. Kind of right behind like father-child kind of stuff, or right in front of father-child stuff, even. So,
no, I as somebody who is adopted and as somebody who hopes in the future to adopt a kid, or at least we've talked to, my wife and I have talked about foster care or foster to adopt and what that would look like in the
Maywood household.
Those metaphors. Yeah, like they, being adopted is something that is, it's hard to describe why that is so significant to my identity and what that entails, but reading those passages of scripture or watching films like Short Term 12 or the film Philomena, or other films that even like a Despicable Me,
yeah,
the first one, and this idea of adopting orphans, these kind of films that deal with family, but in a unique way, because it's not family by blood, it's family by choice, in a sense. Like I am choosing to be committed to this other person. And so in that sense, I guess I can see, and I'm coming around to this as we're talking about it, can see how while Dory isn't necessarily adopted as a child by Marlon, she is brought into their family and calls them family, that this is her family now, and she knows and loves them as that. And that is in some ways a picture of adoption. But what's unique about the film is that there isn't even a competitive spirit about that either by the end. It's not like Marlon feels jilted or like, oh, Dory doesn't like me anymore and they're gone. Like, you know, her parents, they're all reunited. It's all this one big happy family, and it's kind of awesome that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fairly unique portrayal as well, that Dory doesn't end up leaving entirely. She goes off on this journey and this quest and finds her parents, but then home becomes this one big happy family of marine life.
yet another way that the good dinosaur fails is they miss out on that great opportunity. But that was such a, yeah, whenever you started talking about that, I was like, yeah, why did they miss that? They could have done the same thing, and that would have been awesome.
They're telling a different story, a story that apparently you and I did not want to hear. well, and so the thing that we've kind of been circling around is how kids have interpreted it. And something that I would be interested in, because I feel like some of the things were going to be my second question, which is what as adults we're taking away from it. And I think some of the deeper aspects of disability, which I'd like to circle around back to at some point, and this parenting are things that as adults we're finding. But when I think about what kids are taking away, I think more simple terms. Maybe I'm underselling kids these days. They're smart. They have iPhones, whatever. They have the internet. But what I saw, Joel, I think it was you, like the what would Dory do? The keep swimming. Like Griffin, do you see like kids picking up any lessons like that are simple like that? Or is it just too simple?
Yeah, I don't know that I see a kid hearing that what would Dory do and then turning around and making that their own in the way that it's intended. They might, you know, end up running around their house singing keep swimming, and that would be one thing. But once again, I think that it's too... It might be just like too far into the like adult mindset of like, well, Dory's choosing to kind of ignore some things or pursue some things differently than I would because she has less cares because she forgets things, which I think that's just like too many leaps for like a small child. Mm-hmm. And like I said, once again, I might be wrong because I'm not
maybe
a parent,
they're just like singing this.
Haven't been a child in a while, but
has it been that long? Dude?
Yeah, it's been a couple days.
Even that idea of just keep swimming, like, you know, just kind of go with whatever and not necessarily have a plan, just look at whatever you're going to do immediately. I don't know that too many kids need to be taught that.
They just do that, right?
It does that anyway. You know, yeah. Like, whatever is in front of me, whatever shiny object attracts me, that's going to be the thing that I'm going to go to next, which I'm not necessarily sure is something that is, you know, the best message to be sending. Just kind of go. Just look around and go with whatever you feel like going with immediately. I don't know that that's the best thing to be encouraging a distracted generation to be doing.
distracted by what, per se?
Everything. So Joel, you need to sit down with your kids. You would hypothetically need to, were they to like movies and watch this film with you. And say, well...
They're like 25.
Yeah, when they're in college and they're like, Dad, I watch movies all the time. One day they're going to come home and they're going to say, you know, I watched this Hitchcock film in college, and I think there's going to be like tear that rolls down.
Oh gosh,
Father Mayward's face.
I know. I can't wait. Decades from now,
and they're going to say, "Dad, why didn't you tell me?
Why didn't you tell me that Rear Window was the best movie?"
This
ever.
Is the picture of patience we're talking about, right? Like exactly. I'm just going to wait for 20 years, and finally they're going to be like, "Dad, we love movies. These are amazing." They'd be like, "I know. Let me show you something." And then we'll go.
And when they come to the house, there's just like a trail of DVDs, like all the way to the front door, all the way to the couch.
Well, yeah, because if you'd shown them earlier, they would not have understood, right?
They just thought they were shiny cases.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they had these amazing stories in them.
Yeah.
Well, so when you'd sit, if someone were to sit down with their kid who's singing the Keep Swimming song, would it be fair to either interpret it as, which is something I think we would all steer clear of, like, hey, go with whatever's around or whatever's shiny, to Keep Swimming kind of like, don't get down about your circumstances. Like, you just kind of, I don't want to make it sound too humanist, but just kind of keep on keeping on. Like, sometimes you just have to keep going, even if things are hard or they look rough.
Totally. I think it can be interpreted as a message of endurance and optimism. You know, mm-hmm. like I just continue to have hope and continue to strive and push forward and continue mm-hmm. to swim through whatever circumstances are thrown at you without that letting, you know, it bog you down or ruin your day. And that's totally an awesome message in the sense of giving somebody hope and optimism. Who would want to be against that? But if it's just like what we were talking about earlier, if it is just kind of go with the shiny objects or just do whatever you feel like doing in any given moment, then it could end up kind of delving into that super trite, you know, follow your dreams or follow your heart thing,
mm-hmm.
Which again on the surface sounds nice, but once we dig a little bit deeper into it, might be a bit more complex.
Mm-hmm.
I think I like Just Keep Swimming more than I like follow your dreams, even though I don't want to, now I sound like this anti-dreams, anti-heart, anti-feeling guy.
You're fine.
It just sounds like you've read the Bible, Joel. That's what it sounds like.
I want my kids to do both. You know, I want them to have hope and optimism, but also to have endurance and patience.
Mm-hmm.
And, actually, just thinking about that, maybe her parents contrast that as well. Like, Dory's this kind of go with the flow. I'm just going to keep swimming. I'm going to go with whatever immediately happens before me. And her parents are the kind of fish that stay. You know, they don't just keep swimming. They keep doing what they keep putting out shells and they keep trying, mm-hmm. but they don't necessarily. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm inadvertently correcting myself as well. Maybe they do just keep swimming.
Wait.
Just in a way that's embodying
in their
that
own way.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Little fishy mind explode.
Maybe they have their own abilities or disability. Yeah.
Well, can I ask you about something that goes against most of what we've talked about, Griffin?
Go for it.
All right. So, if we are commending Finding Dory as this picture of parental love through patience and like kind of the open-armed waiting years down the road, then does this kind of are we saying this negates Finding Nemo, or are we saying this is better parenting than recklessly pursuing your son? Or is it just a different metaphor?
It's a different metaphor. It's a different metaphor for sure. And because I think that despite being a bit of a helicopter dad, Marlon is a good father. He's just got some, like, He's just a little. He's not perfect. He's a little controlling, mm-hmm. yeah, or a lot controlling. Yeah, he's not perfect. And I think that it's, yeah, I think that Marlon's father is a realistic example of what parenting is going to be. I've had so many friends that have had kids lately or are on their way to that, and I've heard a couple of people say kind of something along the lines of, which the favorite way that I heard it put was this. This guy came to me. He said, "Yeah, he's like, you know, we just adopted a child. We're so pumped." And you know, me and my wife, we've been talking a lot about how we want to parent in the best way we can and try to do it as best as we can, but I'm still going to save them money for counseling.
Yeah.
Because inevitably you're going to screw them. Like inevitably you're going to hurt them. Inevitably you're going to do something that you didn't realize was going to be hurtful. Or, yeah. And I think that Marlon is such a good example of, he's a good father in that he doesn't just tell his son to stay home while him and Dory go find Dory's parents. They all mm-hmm. get on the waterway and they go. And he doesn't just tell Dory to go off on her own. He's like, no, like we'll come with you and we'll continue to be your friends. And I think he shows what a good friend is, what a good father is, to be willing to hear his son. Because I think at the end of the day, like Nemo is the source of truth for Marlon in this film, where he reminds Marlon of the things that he has forgotten
mm-hmm.
all throughout the film.
But to be clear, we still all hate Marlon, right?
Well, by the end, I feel like he has learned some good lessons. Though, thank God, I do not think that there will be another one of these. And, well, except for the fact that finding Hank will be awesome. Maybe that's just a spinoff where it's just Hank, and just like a cameo appearance by all the rest of them.
Why can't it just be a short? Why can't Hank just have a short?
That would be fine. Where I thought that was opening. I thought that was the ending credits was a Hank short. I thought that's what we got.
Where it'd just be like a Mission Impossible.
Yeah, that would be
kind of, you know, 6 minute short.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it is. I think it's just a different metaphor. I don't think that it's a better I don't think that it's painting a picture of a better parent, better set of parents. I'm sure that her parents would have had their own weird stuff that we would have seen had we seen them for longer, being that they were parents and, you know, fish, but human, like, and flawed in their own ways. I think it's a good example, though, of how just people are different. People parent different and they mess up their kids in different ways. And, you know, it's okay as long as you don't ignore that you're doing it. Long as you just aren't, whenever it gets brought back to you that you're just like, no, I never did that. No, that's not a good parent.
Yeah.
And I think Marlon does a great job of acknowledging, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Well, I like what you're saying. And I tend to agree. And Joel may, but since Joel has been a very vocal proponent of the patient parenting, like kind of theme / metaphor / whatever you want to call it, in Finding Dory, where does that put you with Finding Nemo?
Yeah, I think they're still complementary films. Like they mm-hmm. capture what Griffin's talking about, that they're different ways of parenting and different struggles that different parents have. And so I think they capture two different struggles that would occur, and both involve the loss of a child, like a child disappears and how those parents deal with that and how the child deals with that. But those don't necessarily contradict each other in the end. Like Marlon's story and Dory's parents, what they end up learning still comes back to this committed love of their kids. You know, like Marlon's commitment pushes him outside of his comfort zone to cross the entire ocean to go find Nemo and to go on all these crazy adventures that he never would have done otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Dory's parents, their commitment ends up making them stay. And it's because their kids are different, like the situation is different. Even though both are picked up by boats and disappear, I suppose, at some point, and there are some parallels that way, the kind of journey that both parents have to go through is going to be different because the situation with their kids is going to be a bit unique. So mm-hmm. I don't think that they contradict each other necessarily. I think if you're watching both of these films back to back as a parent or with a group of parents, you could have a lot of good discussion afterwards about.
And you should.
Yeah. which fish are you, and what do you relate to, and how do you connect?
Are you more of a Marlin or a Charlie?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and I think that that's the one thing about these films that are great, is that if given the opportunity, you can pull them out and show them in a setting where you encourage people to talk about them after,
mm-hmm.
and you should do that. Like, and that should be a part of a routine that we have. I think whether if we're watching film with us and a whole group of people, or just us and our significant other, or us and a couple of friends, leave the theater, go grab, you know, fries or a beer or whatever you end up doing, and have a good conversation about, okay, we watched this thing, it taught us these things, or it said, had these messages, you know. And yeah, I know that we beat this idea into oblivion, but I know that there are still tons of people out there not doing it. So I'm going to continue to beat it.
Tell your friends.
Until we start having conversations about what we're watching. Because it's just, what is the point? And I understand to some degree, yes, escape is good. I think it's a good place to relax. And you know, it's okay to do that. I think it just doesn't have to be just that. I think it can be a multi-use tool to tell us stories and to be storytellers ourselves, as we're called to be by, like, scripture. We're called to tell stories and to paint pictures for people.
Well, we've got to most of the things that I really wanted to get to. So to sort of wind down, Joel, I would ask you, is there anything that you really wanted to point out that stuck out as like just a come on moment, or something that you wanted to mention as just your favorite moment of the film that really you connected with, or just anything that we didn't really have a chance to talk about?
I think a couple of the things that I found really interesting and compelling was the conversations that Dory has with Hank and his transformation over the course of the film. I also thought the seals or the sea lions, whatever they were, whoever Idris Elba is,
yeah,
that he was hilarious, and Dominic that West. Their moments.
That was great.
So funny. And he's in every talking animated animal film this year. And I just don't know why Idris Elba is like,
cause he's mad. He's mad at Marvel.
he wants to do all the things, man.
Yeah.
Someone told him that, like, I was like, you're at your peak, like, cashability, so cash it in.
Just be in every movie that you could possibly be in. Yeah. And he did a great job. And
we keep seeing home runs, so why wouldn't he be?
Funny. I think the part that really, I guess, jumped the shark, in a sense, or mm-hmm. octopus drove a truck, that might be a new final moment, the chase scene with an octopus driving a truck, was a bit too far-fetched for me, and it kind of got just silly. I was thinking about Up, and I love Up. It's probably one of my favorite. It'd be a top five Pixar film for me. But that final scene with the talking dogs flying airplanes is kind of like, really? Like, this is... It's ridiculous anyway. There were talking dogs in the film, but this just kind of somehow, you know, pushes past the line of relatability and credibility. And I know it's a film about talking animals, so that's not, reality shouldn't matter, but there's something about that in this film with the talking or the driving octopus that I was like, I don't know if this is working for me. So that's a little bit different. It goes off the rails kind of literally on that.
Go ahead.
No, that's it.
Well, I mean, I think that Pixar typically walks this thing where if they flip the screen around and you're the human looking at the thing going on, oftentimes in Pixar movies, they don't understand what's happening. So it's real life still in reality. And I think that, like, what you're talking about, even with Up, that was no longer in reality. Mm-hmm. Like, the rest of it could have sort of happened, sort of. Like, the talking dogs was a little, like, they made it believable because of science. But yeah, with this one, it was sort of, like, unbelievable that he would be like, I got that Dory was telling him where to go, but she said left and he made like a perfect kind of angular turn and not just like what I would do if someone was just like left. I'd be like full left, like 90 degrees. Yeah. And that wasn't what he was doing. So, yeah, my come on moment will continue to be Marlon just not learning his lesson. Mm. Why don't you cash in on that so hard in this film and make him a more likable or lovable character than he was in the last film, in the sense that, like, the last film you gave him credit because, like, he had lost his son just moments before, you know, he started on this trip, and then he lost, like, his wife and all of their kids prior mm-hmm. to that. So you understood why he was sad. It's like the grandpa and Up. Like, I understood why he wouldn't answer the door. Yeah. It made sense. Yeah. When you miss that, it was very, very frustrating that that wasn't followed up on at all and cashed in on it anyway. I was going to also point out, I mean, the kind of co-stars and the supporting cast of this film was hilarious. Jim Gaffigan mm-hmm. as the big beluga whale with like the weird, you know, can't see thing. Was it not Gaffigan? No.
No.
It was.
It was not.
It was.
It was Ty Burrell.
Really?
It was the guy from Family.
From Modern Family. That's where I... Okay, yes. Sorry. You're right. My bad. I'm wrong. Yeah, so like...
Again, he would have used the, oh my God, your voice.
He would have been like, he would have done the little kid voice. Or yeah. like the, yes. Yes.
Yeah,
Dominic West and Idris Elba doing the whole thing. That was hilarious, especially with like the super dumb, super like weird looking other one that just like that was so funny. I Gerald. Yeah. Gerald. Yes. That was really good. And yeah, I feel like lots of great supporting cast in this movie. Bill Hader has also been in a lot of really great animated films as of late. He was he was that little the husband and wife fish who like try to help Dory. Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah. So I think that there's just they got that right in so many ways in this film. And yeah, I still like I just Gerald.
Yeah, I think we're highlighting the fact that it's. I get the sense that we're all a bit more on the positive side of things than negative on this film.
Yeah, yeah. Rating wise, it's well above. It's a well above like average for me. And this is like film. Oh yeah, it's a great. Well, it's a really good Pixar movie. It's better than most.
So there's two things I have to say about that, and I guess I don't necessarily want to detract if you guys wanted to talk themes anymore, but I wonder if. We say a film like this is like pretty good because the Pixar bar is so high or like, is that why we're doing that?
Oh, if we're talking about
just animated films
or animated, like if we're talking about films this year, it's a top 10 film this year. maybe even top 5 film this year. If we're talking about animated films versus like Pixar. For me, it's like Pixar and Miyazaki and then everything else. Mm. And I think it just shows up in the like depth to which these themes exist. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't need no kid needed me to explain how Frozen worked and what that story was. There's no depth.
Well, but Disney, there is. Disney's but there's, been hitting it out of the park. I mean, Zootopia was great.
It was I
just don't know if go ahead.
I was wondering, like, which of those two films, back to Idris Elba talking animal films, so between The Jungle Book and Zootopia and Finding Dory, you know, which of those three films, because those are, and now we've got The Secret Life of Pets, I don't think Idris Elba is in that, but he would have been, maybe he is, actually, I have no idea, I haven't seen that film yet.
I'm kind of hoping not.
Like I do think I enjoyed Zootopia a bit better than Finding Dory simply because it was a bit more of an original idea where this was, you know, a sequel and kind of just, I don't know. There's a lot of sequels that have come out in 2016. It's been the year of sequels and talking animals, and Finding Dory is both. And so that kind of makes it a little bit less appealing to me. But you're right, like in terms of animated films in general, and most of the films of 2016 thus far, it's a solid film. And there's nothing, maybe I'm as critical as I am about it because I've seen how good Pixar can be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And some of their recent stuff, Inside Out, I would argue is brilliant and one of their better,
mm-hmm.
Better films. The Good Dinosaur, I didn't bother seeing, to be honest, because of the criticisms that you guys have leveled at it and others have leveled at it. And they're kind of hit and miss recently. And Finding Dory finds its way just kind of in the middle of, like, this is a good film. This was fine, but it isn't necessarily top-notch Pixar. Mm-hmm. But that's still better than most of the things we're seeing.
Yeah,
this year.
I think when I say better than most earlier, I was like thinking in my head, I was like, well, not better than most Pixar movies, better than most animated movies.
Yeah.
Because, I think this is like, I think there's like, what, 15, 16 Pixar movies?
You're the Pixar man.
If that's the case, you're looking at like bottom five for this one.
Really?
And yeah, I mean.
Oh, see, that's going to hurt my feelings because, see, you and Joel share something in common where.
We love WALL-E.
No.
We do love WALL-E.
Yes! We share that in common.
Hey,
that's my number one.
I love
this is awesome.
I love half of WALL-E just as much as the next guy.
Okay, continue.
But both of you, I have been excited to have on for particular podcasts because we've all been amped up. And I think I even said this in the email to you guys, or at least I was I was talking to you about this, Joel, that I hope that when you're on this next one, like I'm gonna have you guys on a podcast or an episode of the show where we love the movie, where it's not gonna be we're excited, and we're pretty let down by the movie, but we've already committed to doing it.
Yeah,
you know, and I know that's happened with Griffin a number of times, and I know like I was personally amped about Tomorrowland, and I know Joel was pretty amped about Tomorrowland, and we kind of were like, ooh.
That movie.
Yeah, so
that's like one of those ones where you don't talk about it later. You're like, someone brings it up, you're like, no, too soon.
So I remember saying, look, I'm gonna have you guys on for Finding Dory because there's no way that this could be bad, right?
No, that's I think my hope is that that will be true for like the next few, especially mm-hmm. a lot of the my hope is that that will be true. I've seen the previews, but I can't remember the name of it. The Disney movie that's coming out later this year about the,
like the Moa.
Yeah, that has a really cool look to it. And I'm like hoping I'm getting pretty hopped for that. Like, I'm excited about it.
I was going to say, it's Disney, man.
But Pixar, I feel like when it comes to Pixar, the next 5 years or so, that, you know, they've kind of come out and said they don't have any in plans after Incredibles 2. Or Toy Story 4 to do whichever one comes out later to do any other they don't have any sequels in the works, and I'm sure that what they have announced is like the next five. Mm-hmm. They probably have planned what the next 15. I'm guessing like at least the next 10.
I'm gonna say they probably got tons and tons of ideas laying around.
Yeah,
and trying to make
that's exciting. Like their original stuff ends up being I'll take a Toy Story sequel anytime you want to give it, but for the most part, I'd prefer
original
stuff because they're good at telling a full story in its completion and say, here you go.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, because I enjoyed Finding Dory, again, comparatively to other animated films or even the films that I've seen in 2016, I enjoyed Finding Dory pretty well. But just the other day, we had some friends over and they had never seen Inside Out, and we're down here in my basement watching Inside Out, and I'm still going, oh my goodness, this film is like amazing.
Yeah.
And I definitely didn't have that feeling watching Finding Dory, or when we rewatched Finding Nemo right before we went to see Finding Dory. I was kind of like, well, all right.
Yeah, but Inside Out's like top three, top five. I would assume if you've seen all of them, if you've seen all the Pixar movies,
and you have a heart.
Inside Out's like top three, top five Pixar movies.
Yeah, it keeps moving up every time I see it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to start ranking off the top five for me, mm-hmm. but yeah,
I feel like we have. I think we did on Good Dinosaur, maybe.
Did we discuss it?
I think I asked you.
Yeah, I think we did discuss it that mm-hmm. show. Anyways, yes.
We had plenty of time because we weren't talking about the Good Dinosaur.
We weren't, well, we were just
But you should, raining, so Joe, I would be really interested.
On it.
And it, you know, hey, I have had plenty of discussions about the good dinosaur, not to make this about the good dinosaur, but I have had plenty of good discussions about the good dinosaur with people who enjoyed it to varying levels of degree.
Yeah.
We've had those conversations on the Real World Theology Facebook group, and people have given me reasons that I don't necessarily disagree with. Obviously, I just don't feel like it came together as a whole. I didn't really buy into it. But that doesn't mean, again, we're all different. We're coming at it with different lenses. We're coming at it from different joys and pains in our own life. And so we're all going to see film different. And that's the beauty of talking about things like Griffin was so passionate about already encouraging people to do. Like, talk about these things. You're looking at stories, and stories have a beautiful way to connect with everybody in lots of different ways. So if you like The Good Dinosaur, kudos. I would prefer never have to watch it again. I'm actually curious. Like, Joel, I would say you should watch it.
Okay.
Because it's a Pixar film. The Good Dinosaur, for me, at the time, was probably the first Pixar film I said that I would never want to show my kid. Even Cars 2, I was like, yeah, he could probably enjoy this on some level. But
yeah, those are the only two Pixar films I've not seen yet, mm-hmm. is Cars 2 and The Good Dinosaur. And partly for the reasons that, you know, that you guys have stated, that they're just kind of middle of the road mm-hmm. animated films, and probably the less, they're not as good as other Pixar films. They're just not up to the same standard for whatever reason. And so I just haven't taken the time to be able to seek them out. But mm-hmm. because they are Pixar films, I want to understand even why they went the route that they did with these particular films, mm-hmm. and some of the themes that they, it sounds like The Good Dinosaur really plays with those themes of parenthood as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about a vast majority of Pixar films really deal with that, of what it means to be a good parent and mm-hmm. how to be a parent to your kid, or how to be a good child, and what family relationships really look like. And so to see that from a different perspective from The Good Dinosaur, even if it's not that great, I'd still check it out. The animation looked good. Like, it looked photorealistic, some of the stuff that I saw in the trailer. So.
Oh, it's by far the most beautiful that they've ever made.
Visually, it is, it is photorealistic. I actually wondered if they...
That made me think of something, which is the short film right before Dory, Piper.
Yes.
Which is about the most amazing animation I think I've ever seen on the big screen, even for a short film. Like, mm-hmm. If you had told me that this was a real little bird doing its thing, and, you know, Planet Earth, the BBC people had somehow got their cameras down there in the sand and they were showing this, I probably would have believed that for the first half of the film. It was so remarkable and so well done. The water, the way that they animated that, I really liked it. And that's mm-hmm. the parent.
I was going to say,
Beautiful.
Piper was probably my favorite short in a very long time.
Yeah, I think since I saw Paper was the last time I got that like where I like went to go watch find a short again, which Paper's the mm-hmm. one about the guy and the girl getting on the train and mm-hmm. the airplanes. Yeah, I think that was the last time I got that amped about a short. Mm-hmm. And
I loved it.
I would give that 5 stars. If they said if they announced a movie for that tomorrow, that is one situation where I wouldn't be upset and be like, "Well, you can't turn that into a movie." I'd be like, "No, you can. Have at it." But
I love Piper.
Did you see the length of credits on that short? I mean, it was intense. It was intense. Like the credits were probably like, what, 15 seconds for a short? I mean, I was just like, okay, all right, cool. Lots of people. Which made sense. I mean, it was a pretty impressive film. So
yeah, that was actually probably my favorite part of the Finding Dory. I remember watching that short and I was like, what?
Yeah.
It'd be worth getting a ticket to Finding Dory just to go see that, to be honest, and to see it on a big screen in that kind of format.
I won't suggest other ways you can watch it. So. Yeah. I'll send you some links, Joel.
Well, if there is if there's nothing else that you guys want to make sure we catch before we wrap up, then I will thank you both for taking the time. I know navigating time zones and bedtimes and dinners are always tricky, and so I appreciate you guys being here and having this conversation about Pixar's latest pretty good film.
Pretty good.
As we wait for their next offering. So as we always do, we encourage people to go to the Facebook discussion group, keep talking about this film. What were your thoughts on Finding Dory? Where do you think it ranks among Pixar's film? Where do you think it ranks among the 2016 films in general? Do you think it probably deserves to be the highest grossing domestic film of the year so far? All that, like I said, take those comments there. Well, whenever this shows up, we'll have a link to it. In the meantime, I want to make sure that you can continue these conversations or follow the very smart, brilliant, exciting, awesome adjective work of our guests. So, Joel, how can people follow you and follow the things that you're into?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Joel Mayward, J-O-E-L-M-A-Y-W-A-R-D, or you can read my film reviews at my website, cinemayward.com. Those are probably the two best ways to follow what I write about when it comes to film.
Excellent. Griffin, same question, man. How can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can keep up with me in the Facebook group that Mikey was talking about. I check that on the regular and see almost everything that gets posted in there. Yeah, you can find me on Facebook as well. And then outside of that, yeah, I've got a couple of reviews coming up of older stuff on the website, but amidst moving and probably moving again and the life changes, things will get a little hectic over the next few months. But hopefully, yeah, my next film, like the Director's Cut series, is going to be animated director, which I'm really excited about. And so I'm excited to put that out and have some people look at that.
So be looking for that at www.realworldtheology.com.
Thank you for coming to check us out there. Back to you, Bob.
So if you want to follow me, you can do that at Fizzification on Twitter. You will probably find me posting multiple things, even obnoxiously, in the Facebook discussion group on Facebook. So join us there.
What does Nintendo putting out a new gaming console have to do with Real World Theology?
How could it not?
How does it have to do anything? I was like, why do I have to see this here?
People, we've developed such a beautiful community of people who just want to share life with each other.
That is not the people I want to have that conversation with.
Anyway, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a review. Make sure you're downloading the show, subscribe to the show. You can get us on all the platforms. Like I said, we really appreciate your 5-star reviews and your comments, because the more feedback you leave, the easier it is for people to find us. And the more people find us, the more people join the conversation. And hopefully that means we're increasing the quality of the conversation, because everyone's coming from somewhere different.
Yep.
And we're all seeing these stories from different angles. So we're grateful for our excellent guests. Thank you guys. Make sure you're following them on social media, around the web, anything that they're doing. Check it out. You won't be sorry. We're thankful for you, the listeners, because it is something that I do not take for granted, that you take time out of your week to listen to this episode and this podcast in general. So thank you. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
I have been off Facebook for 2 months now. And
your life has just increased in joy and happiness and contentment.
It's actually true.
And then still admin, still take care of this thing.
But then you have to friend everyone back.
No, you don't have to friend it. You just unfollow them.
But when he's inevitably going to return to Facebook.
No.
It's going
to... No.
Obviously, it's happening. Hey.
It's a good suggestion.
Everyone comes back, Griffin.
It's
not
true.
Really. Yeah, I came back. I'm not saying that that's everyone. There are some people who say off.
I don't just keep saying the same things. Like, this is great. This is wonderful. The action was the good.